Welcome to this week's very packed podcast. On today's podcast, you will hear Billy Brentford introducing a CD No Lefty Should Be Without, SSP co-spokesperson Sandra Webster on the recent victory of grassroots activists in Renfrewshire, Don McKean on the recent history, sociology and politics of the mainstream media, Alessio Gentili on poverty porn. Callum Martin continues his journey through left-wing history today with a piece on the First French Republic. And Neil Anderson brings to life John McLean's famous 1918 speech from the dock. First, Wild Salmon and Remember or Grieve.
Don't I know you? I've seen you before. You stuck the boots in while I was pinned to the floor. Well, now I'm back on my feet and my bruises have healed. I laughed as you squirmed when your lies were revealed. The strands come apart from the web that you weave, just think back. Remember or grieve. You stood armored with baton and shield, flanked by horses lined up in that field, and you steamed into strikers with impunity as cronies edited footage to show on TV. But we'll fight until justice and truth is achieved. Just think back. Remember or grieve.
Hello, my name is Billy Brentford. I play guitar in the revolutionary socialist supergroup The Concerned Citizens, and I sing with the legends of revolutionary socialist R&B from Reigate, The Faction. I want to talk to you about something that both groups are involved with, the Orgreave Truth and Justice campaign. You're probably aware of the campaign, an idea to raise money for lawyers, essentially, to support the miners and their families that were involved in the punch-ups that Orgreave, in one of the most bitter episodes that took place during the miners' strike, and particularly the Battle of Orgreave, really because of the anniversary of the return to work by the striking miners, which happened this year, and partly inspired by the Hillsborough families. The people that are involved in this, the sort of fulcrum of it, are a bunch from Barnsley who were involved in said punch-ups and their family. It's a kind of multi-generational band called the Hurriers, and they're a real cut above this sort of thing. They're a punk rock group. One of their songs, Truth and Justice, is a bit of a minor classic. And as well as events, they've put on some great events. We had a terrific time with Defaction up in Barnsley. They also did a festival in the summer, an outdoor festival, actually on the site of said Punch Up in Orgreave, which was terrific fun with all the usual suspects. An event which was buzzed by a police helicopter in a situation that had a kind of tragi-comic Kurt Vonnegut vibe to it. A most interesting and humorous afternoon and evening of music and dissent. They've now put together a CD, the inevitable next step, I guess, which has an astonishing lineup of acts, 33 in total. It's a tenner. You can buy it from Philosophy Football with one of their T-shirts, or just a tenner for the CD. Just Google Orgreave Truth and Justice campaign. They're on Twitter as well, at Orgreave Justice. All the usual suspects are on there: Steve White and the Protest Family, Billy Bragg, Attila, the stockbroker, Blaggers ITA, the Hurriers themselves, Sleaford Mods, TV Smith from the adverts. We're on it as well, The Faction and The Concerned Citizens. But I want to play a track on the podcast, if I may, by Louise Distress. I'm so pleased that she's finally put together a band, because her form of punk rock should really be heard with bass and drums. So Louise is going to be touring Europe with a three-piece band shortly. So a little bit of old-school punk rock from a young 21st century woman. This is called Bullets. And this, from the Orgreave Truth and Justice CD, is Louise Distress.
Moments that become ingrained in your memory forever, like an LP record, all scratched, or a snapshot from a Polaroid camera, frozen in time. You're probably, like me, are aware of all the 70s photographs yourself, and you can just go back there and see what happened at that time. Most of them for me are all about my family. A few are political. Snapshot one. Sitting with a group of mainly women carers and their children, being told from an executive from the health board that the REH Children's Ward would close. He already knew the procedure. There would be, of course, no consultation, but he told us that the Children's Ward would be closed in a year's time. They'd already decided. However, they had not expected the anger and determination of parents and carers about why the ward should stay open. Many of our children lived with life-limiting disorders. We needed the support of a ward, so we decided to organise, and we did, creating a rainbow grassroots campaign. We picketed the health board on cold days. We gave them all mince pies. We even dressed up as Santa. We consulted lawyers regarding the human rights of our children to have access to a ward. We were always a grassroots-led coalition. The SSP played a huge part, organising the first meeting. But for me, as a parent, and even at that time just starting off as a member of the SSP, it was about the need for a local service and being with other people who needed that. 2 years ago, we were told that the ward was safe from closure, and we celebrated. I'm going now to snapshot number two. I am outside Renfrew Town Hall, where the Scottish Government are visiting. I am holding the banner of Kids Need Our Ward alongside another parent, Jack. There was lots of other demonstrators there that day, including Scrap Trident. But about 2 hours into the demo, Douglas Alexander, the only word I can use is snuck into the photo opportunity. He was there for a maximum of 30 minutes. I remember looking at the man and just thinking, this man is Mr. Photo Opportunity. And I just felt so angry about that. Douglas attended none of our meetings, even other photo calls. So I was surprised this last weekend when he claimed he had saved the ward by writing to Trona Robinson. In the days before International Women's Day, this represents how well patriarchy is alive and kicking. The Kids Need Our Ward or No campaign was a group made mostly of parents and supporters, and we had the support of politicians throughout the political spectrum, from Labour to SNP. However, we know that this is our victory, but many of us feel horrified that Douglas would claim it as his own only because a general election is looming. This is not the end, just a reprieve. As I said before, elections are looming in the next few years. Who would close the children's ward with that coming up? But however, it is good to celebrate a victory, especially a true grassroots one, which I am proud that I was at the heart of, along with other mums like Karen and Caroline. I support you all. Thanks for helping. It's our victory, and we know who helped us.
This is The Hurriers from the CD Billy mentioned earlier, and this is Truth and Justice.
Manners didn't come from yachts or fools, but no, hang on, you're right, it did when they were dressed in blue. It turned into a brief for all to see who were the most. South Yorkshire, please let the pack, but they were just a host. Charged took to stand and struck to levels never seen. The press knew what was going on, but they're a lie machine. The powers knew the reasons why they had to win that day. They made it clear to the coffers, it could only go one way. Supported by the women.
defeated. The miners united will never be defeated.
Recently on Twitter, Seanagh McKinnon, who is the head of communications for the Church of Scotland, tweeted, "Hear students say, I get all my news from Twitter. Scary or what? Twitter is a selective bubble." And she put the hashtag, buy a paper. It's true enough that Twitter can be a selective bubble, but the problem is papers aren't much better. For instance, back in September 2002, New York Post had a cover story, Doomsday Plot. And they said that the threat has been raised in secret intelligence assessments. The officials came up with the nightmare scenario, which could include easily concealed briefcase biobombs, after concluding that Saddam has few options available once U.S. attacks begin. And the problem with that, of course, is, I mean, we know now that was nonsensical, but also, you know, it's lines like officials came up with and could include. So, I mean, yeah, are they just making it up then? Then more recently, when Syriza won the election in Greece, papers like the Daily Mail and the Sunday Times were pushing this idea that that actually Syriza was a Trojan horse for Putin, and that he was just using Syriza to pick fights with the European Union because, for instance, they were going to delay agreement on further EU sanctions against Russian-backed separatists in Ukraine. Now, there are, of course, reasons to be critical of Russia, but there are reasons to be critical of NATO's involvement in Ukraine, particularly we know that there are fascists who have been involved in that coup. It isn't straightforward and it isn't simple, but it's usually always framed in a certain way. And you can see it pretty clearly, I think, if you look at it according to Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's idea of a propaganda model of media. So their argument was that, yes, it's clear in a dictatorship you can see how the media works and functions for the people in power. But, you know, the people living in that country, well, they pretty much see that the news they're getting isn't very accurate. The government tells them output is up and they go to the shops, there's nothing on the shelves. You stop believing what your government says and you just keep quiet. It's a dictatorship. We're free to say what we want in places like the UK and the US, up to a point. Chomsky and Herman suggest that all media in a capitalist society goes through five filters. The first one is concentrated ownership. So all the big media companies are owned by big corporations. Now, the Internet's made things a little easier. So in Scotland, we have Newsnet Scotland. We've got Bella Caledonia. But if you want big reach, you need a lot of capital behind you. The second filter is advertising. The New York Times, something like 3/4 of their revenue comes from advertising. And you can imagine then the effect that that's going to have on the stories that they're producing. The third filter is reliance on information provided by expert and official sources. Like you look at that one I was just quoting earlier, the New York Post story about the Doomsday Plot. So intelligence officials, you know, we're raising these nightmare scenarios. We don't know who they are, but they're official sources, so they must be trustworthy. The fourth filter is flack, and that's basically the way that, say, Exxon, Texaco can form these phony activist groups that will then bombard news organizations with all sorts of complaints if there's anything about climate change, and they're always going to then be able to question something that's not in their corporate interests. The last filter is an external enemy or threat. Now, when Chomsky and Herman wrote Manufacturing Consent, where they talked first about this propaganda model, it was during the Cold War, so they talked about anti-communism. But now we can talk about the external threat. It's always some doomsday threat of terrorism or evil dictators like Saddam. You know, okay, at one point when Saddam gassed the Kurds in Halabja during the Iran-Iraq war, he was a friend of Ronnie Reagan, so there was no questions asked. But then he was no longer of any use when George Bush the first invaded Iraq, and so everything changed, and he became a new Hitler. Now, the thing is Chomsky and Herman have pointed out, this isn't a new idea that they're proposing. They're just trying to make it easier for us to see how it works. Orwell wrote a preface to Animal Farm in 1937, which wasn't published. And he said, "The sinister fact about literary censorship in England is that it is largely voluntary. Unpopular ideas can be silenced and inconvenient facts kept dark without the need for any official ban. Anyone who has lived long in a foreign country will know of instances of sensational items of news being kept right out of the British press, not because the government intervened, but because of a general tacit agreement that it wouldn't do to mention that particular fact.
This is Steve White and the Protest Family with When an Anarchist Helps You Cross the Road.
Once told us many years ago, Jesus was a socialist. The Bible tells us so. Do unto others as you would have done to you, it's obvious. So he didn't have a clue or when he went to church. Up and down the aisles, the rows and rows of Tories wearing hypocrite smiles. Robert Tressel might have told him, and the knowledge might have flowed, that he's probably an anarchist helping him across the road. Yeah, don't be surprised, don't be alarmed, you won't come to no harm. Yeah, don't be surprised, don't be blown when an anarchist helps you cross the road. Never mind the bankers, cause they're red hots, and they're earning bonuses while we're losing jobs. Adam Smith said the market is all that you need, it's obvious, but it relies on greed. If you believe what's right, if you believe what's fair, you don't want the government taking your share. Don't buy anything tomorrow, erase your barcode. Don't be surprised when an anarchist helps you across the road. Yeah, don't be surprised, don't be alarmed, you won't come to no harm. Yeah, don't be surprised, don't be blowed when an anarchist helps you cross the road. Wants to smash the system, but a window will do. He understands a revolution may take a day or two. Altruism can't compete with exploitation, it's obvious, but it's a capitalist nation. The haves tell the have-nots what to do. Is a ballot box enough for you? Sit back and watch the fireworks, watch Parliament explode, and then wait for an anarchist to help you across the road. Yeah, don't be surprised, don't be alarmed, you won't come to no harm. Yeah, don't be surprised, don't be blown when an anarchist helps you cross the road.
Hello there. My name is Alessio Gentile. I am a member of the Scottish Socialist Party and an officer for the Glasgow South branch. I would like to talk about the demonisation of people on benefits. So shows such as Benefit Street and other forms of regurgitated poverty porn that is on the mainstream media is created and aired to put regular working class people against people who are on benefits and who are destitute and demonised as a result of brutal austerity measures that are being forced through. The whole idea is to whip people into a frenzy and to keep the public's eye off the real benefit thieves, the bankers, the monarchy, and every politician and bureaucrat who legitimises the unfair system that we live in. We socialists, however, must recognise and challenge these divide and conquer tactics at every opportunity. There is no such thing as three generations of the benefits class. Not one bit of research carried out has ever found such cases to be a common occurrence. And there's the same sort of rhetoric peddled by Ian Duncan Smith and his soon-to-be Labour predecessor, Rachel Reeves. And of course, that is echoed throughout the mainstream press with their sensationalist articles and news reports. However, I'll draw a reference to some research carried out by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation on witlessness recently in 2012. And I quote, "The research was unable to uncover evidence of a culture of witlessness among families. The key conclusion, therefore, is that politicians and policymakers need to abandon theories and policies flowing from them that see witlessness as primarily the outcome of a culture of witlessness held in families and passed down the generations." So, with these shows, we always hear some rhetoric after them. One of the most common ones we often hear is, "But all they do is sit all day on their couch, smoking fags, taking drugs and drinking." Well, okay, let's hear this from a few angles and bust this myth. First of all, most single adults only get 40% of the money that is actually acceptable to live on if they are on benefits, while couples with two or more children only receive 64% of the amount that would be acceptable for them to live on. And also, it's worth noting that less than 10% of Job Seekers Allowance claimants are actually on Job Seekers Allowance for more than 1 year. In fact, $1 billion of the benefit bill is overpaid due to fraud. That's nothing in comparison to the $70 billion that is lost through illegal tax evasion. And this includes a 2.8% fraud rate for Job Seekers Allowance and a tiny 0.3% rate of fraud for incapacity benefit. Even if we put this together with customer error, i.e. people who are not entitled to benefits but do not deliberately defraud the state, the rate of false claims is 3.4% for Job Seekers Allowance and 1.2% for incapacity benefits. And this stat actually comes from the Department of Work and Pensions itself. So, what work is out there for people? Low pay, 0-hour contracts that ensure people are held to ransom by their employers and are kept in line due to the fear of being fired? As that seems to be all there is, especially those of my generation who are not skilled workers in the trades or who have just come out of university but can't yet practice their newly acquired skills, then there isn't much choice. The majority of people, you will find, do want to work. However, sometimes that is not cost effective for them, given their individual circumstance, such as losing housing benefit or childcare issues. As we live in a capitalist world that bangs on about economic viability, that seems to cut big business slack when it comes to saving, either by avoiding tax or treating its workforce with contempt, we have an entirely different attitude when it comes to the individual who actually has genuine needs, unlike big business that is driven by nothing but corporate greed. So really, can you blame people for not wanting to work for low wages and 0-hour contracts? We also must remember that as women who are on the receiving end of worse pay as opposed to us men, this is on top of every other mountain our sisters have to climb just to be classed as a member of society. Also, considering the TV and every other bit of accessible media is basically corporate advertising, you cannot blame the unmedia savvy people for falling for the propaganda that is corporate advertising, considering it is rammed into their minds every fucking minute of the day. Everything from junk food to alcohol is constantly hammered into the minds of the public as a result of this consumerist society. So there really shouldn't be a surprise when you see people spending what little money they do have on a small pleasure as a result of this rampant consumerism. And of course, the most common one we do here in terms of rhetoric: immigrants come over here and take our jobs /benefits. Is that right? Aye. Okay, what is this we've got here? Schrodinger's immigrant? Again, it's just rhetoric that does not make any sense once any sort of logic is actually applied to it. Immigrant workers are actually exploited worse with having no rights, worse working conditions, longer hours, and of course, receiving a much lower rate of pay for their labour. And they actually tend not to claim benefits. In fact, most immigrants don't even live in social housing. They are exploited by greedy landlords. I don't see the same people up in arms about a few chancers in a welfare system, up in arms about the fucking bankers who rob us every day. When the crash happened and quantitative easing began, 1,000 schools that were planned to be built by the UK government were scrapped. That would have cost around £10 billion. Instead, money, £375 billion of it, was printed and flooded into the financial market, where only shareholders are benefited, and everything else has gotten dearer for the rest of us that aren't shareholders. And considering the majority of the country are not shareholders, we are not exactly getting the benefits of such a move that we are told that the wealth will trickle down to us. If £10 billion of that printed money was used to build the 1,000 schools instead, the economy would have been much better. Around 50,000 jobs would have been created. There would have been an improvement to our education system, which is much needed. But no, the elite just keep their elite pals in the right and just want the rest of us to fight amongst ourselves as another dose of poverty porn is injected to your mind via the brainwash box as television. And I'll finish on this. Don't judge people on benefits while you're in a comfortable environment with your fitted kitchen, car in the driveway, and holiday to the Mediterranean every year, as that could easily be you one day. After all, the majority of people in this country are two pay slips away from being in that situation themselves that people like to prod and poke fun at. And I'll say it again, it's the bankers you need to be getting angry about, people. It's not a few chancers that the media are exploiting to fit their own picture. Thank you again.
This is a track I played in a previous podcast, but it's become a real favourite of mine, and I make no apologies for playing it again. It's by a new Paisley band, Travel Cat, and this is Colours 3. Thank you.
Hello, and welcome to Making the Flag Red, a series looking at the struggle and democratic movement for history. I'm Callum Martin of Edinburgh South and Midlothian SSP. Last week, we began a two-part edition looking at the French Revolution, starting by looking at the establishment of the First French Republic and picking up where we left off this week. Now, the winter of 1792, to pick up where we left off, proved a difficult start for the new republic. The balance of power rested uneasily in France that year, for by the end of 1792, the balance of power was quite thinly spread. The king was still alive and waiting in prison. He was waiting as German and Austrian armies moved westwards to invade the young republic. Meanwhile, royalist forces began to agitate and take up arms, giving the king reason to nurture hope of a restoration of the French monarchy. Meanwhile, in the National Convention, the National Assembly, the French Parliament, the balance of power was fraught between the Girondists and the Jacobins. Now, the Jacobins, or at least the term Jacobin, are probably the more familiar of the two groups in this day and age. The Jacobins represented by far the more radical of the two groups. The Jacobins had supported bringing down the monarchy for far longer than the Girondists, and favoured a centralised French Republic, which would ultimately promote, in their minds, radical, by the standards of the time, egalitarian policies. Now, the Girondists, meanwhile, represented a rather different constituency. Unlike the Jacobins, whose power base probably lay most heavily in Paris itself, the Girondists represented elements more from the outlying cities and regions of France. They argued primarily for a liberal democracy. Now, having initially supported the failed constitutional monarchy of previous years, they eventually came to propose a federal republic within France. There's some debate over the reasoning behind this. Some have argued that it represents a principled stance for local government. Others have argued that it does represent more, it's more indicative of the distribution of their support in the outlying regions. Suffice to say, that was the policy they came to rally around. Now, as hyperinflation and food shortages struck Paris in the winter of 1792 and the dawn of 1793, the balance of power began to swing. The Girondists were at this stage in power themselves. Now, on the 16th of January, the king was executed for treason. On the wave of momentum that followed, the Jacobins began to use their influence on the sans-culottes, the increasingly armed and politicised groupings that arose from the streets of Paris, to guarantee their own security in the city against the forces of the Girondists, and ultimately decided to seize power in May of 1793. Purging the parliamentary bodies in Paris of suspected royalists and leading Girondists, they launched a process known by many now as the Terror, where in an attempt to consolidate their power in France and to break the will of the royalist and Girondist factions, the Jacobins turned to the guillotine to remove their political opponents. They argued that the Republic could only survive the brewing civil war within and the coalition invasion from without by establishing a strong sense of discipline within the Republic. Now, whilst the Jacobins had set out to establish egalitarian and socially progressive directions for France, the purges eventually came to play badly in French public opinion. Many newspapers which initially had supported them came to view Robespierre and other Jacobin leaders as having gone too far in seizing power for themselves over enacting the ambitions they'd initially set out with. Eventually, in mid-1794, the Jacobins were overthrown. Robespierre himself lost the personal support of the National Convention, the French Parliament, and was arrested by French forces. Those Girondists who had now survived returned to government and began preparing to stage a new round of elections in an attempt to secure a new Girondist government. Now, the Girondists at this stage began to move away from the controlled economy, not to be confused with a planned economy, that the Jacobins had been operating in France during this period. The result? Inflation almost instantly returned and the economy began to crumble, hitting the poorest hardest. Now, at this stage came a real turning point in the revolution. The National Guard and the armed citizens of Paris attempted to take arms against the decision to end the controlled economy. In an attempted rising in Paris, the government of the Republic, the Girondists at this stage, pulled off a feat not managed to this point. They rallied enough loyal government troops themselves to put down an armed rising by force. Now, despite this initial success, the Republic's days were numbered, but not from a source you might suspect. Whilst the government tried hard to establish a political balance, it didn't necessarily ultimately succeed. They never managed to resolve the issue of risings on the streets of Paris, largely stemming from the economic issues. Now, a young general and aspiring political figure within the establishment, Napoleon Bonaparte, began his ascent to power at this stage. Exploiting his role in securing the government against the rising people of Paris, Bonaparte rose through the ranks of the political establishment, ultimately closing it down from within, and thus went on to end the First French Republic and came to crown himself as ruler of the First French Empire. Now, whilst the ideals of the revolution were quite implemented in the end, the ideals and ideas it spread of democratic rule, universal rights, citizenship and republicanism endured across Europe. They spread widely through wars, through influence, through writings, through pamphlets. Europe was a hubbub of ideas at this stage, and these ideas have done much to shape the world we see today. Now, next week we'll be taking a look at some of the influence these ideas had in Scotland during this period. But until then, I've been Callum Martin. Thanks for listening.
King Mark, did you see him as he came down the Gorky? Away out the Lavalon, not for a day. Young man is coming, now the whole town is turning out. We'll all sure hear we're back to Glasgow today. The joiners and porters are marching through Claybank. Come on now and hear them, get the old flag to bind. Come on, Jock and Jimmy, leave your cranes and your buckle gantries. Great John McLean is coming home to fight. Argyle Street and London Road to Route that we're marching. The last bit of your heart from the sharp big heel and chuck to get your pipes made and march at the heads of the clan. Scotland belongs to him. Big John McLean is coming home to fight. And onwards to Glasgow, Greenbow March in good order. Wilkins is part of all that boy is the blade. Hey look man, it's Johnny, now that's him. That's the body fighter. Lennon's his comrade, Connie's his mate. Springburn, come in for your tea, John, we'd soon have you fed. It's hard work that's speaking, but I'm sure he'll be tired the night. I'll sleep on the floor, man, give John my bed. The whole city's quiet, it knows that he's resting, and home with his Glasgow friends of joy and their pride. The red banner's waving, Scotland will march again. Now the great John McLean has come home to the Clyde.
And the John McLean March. In these anniversary years of some of the most vicious, murderous battles ever fought in the world, that were World War I, the government never mentioned the real struggles for peace, equality and social justice that went on here in Scotland. Many people were rounded up and imprisoned for opposition to the war. John McLean, Scotland's most famous socialist son from the early 20th century, was one of these people, arrested for sedition in early 1918. His speech from the dock has become one of the core tenets of Scottish socialism since. It has been quoted in the American Senate and at various times over the past century during times of struggle. Here we finish with Acting Strange Theatre Company's Neil Anderson, who gives life to an excerpt from this famous speech.
For the full period of my active life, I've been a teacher of economics to the working classes. And my contention has always been that capitalism is rotten to its foundations and must give place to a new society. I had a lecture, the principal heading of which was, "Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill." And I pointed out that as a consequence of the robbery that goes on in civilised countries today, our respective countries have had to keep armies, and that inevitably our armies must clash together. On that and on other grounds, I consider capitalism the most infamous, bloody and evil system that mankind has ever witnessed. My language is regarded as extravagant language. But the events of the past 4 years have proved my contention. My motives are clean. My motives are genuine. My motives were not clean and genuine. Would I have made my statements while these shorthand reporters were present? I am out for the benefit of society, not for any individual human being. But I realise this, that justice and freedom can only be obtained when society is placed on a sound economic basis. That sound economic basis is wanting today, and hence the bloodshed we are having. I have not tried to get young men particularly. The young men have come to my meetings as well as old men. I know quite well that in the reconstruction of society, the class interests of those who are on top will resist the change. And the only factor in society that can make for a clean sweep in society is the working class. Hence, the class war. The whole history of society has proved that society moves forward as a consequence of an underclass overcoming the resistance of a class on top of them. So much for that. I wish no harm to any human being, but I, as one man, am going to exercise my freedom of speech. No human being on the face of the earth, no government is going to take from me my right to speak, my right to protest against wrong, my right to do everything that is for the benefit of mankind. I am not here, then, as the accused. I am here as the accuser of capitalism, dripping with blood from head to foot. The country has been exploited by the capitalist in every sphere to get the toilers to work harder to bring victory. I said at the commencement of the war that while this was being done, and while assurances were being given that at the end of the war the people would get back to normal, I said that circumstances would make such a return impossible. Now I have ample evidence to support that belief. I have used it at my meetings at Weirs of Kirkcart, that they were asking the workers to work harder and harder because there is going to be the war after the war. The economic war which brought on this war. You see, therefore, the workers are brought into the position where they are speeded up and they are never allowed to get back again. They are speeded up again and again. What is the position of the worker? This country is not a free country. The worker is deprived of land or access to the land. He is deprived of workshops or access to the materials and the tools of production. The worker has only one thing to do in the market, and that is to sell his labour power. The capitalist purchased that labour power, and when he gets the worker inside the workshop, his business is to extract as much of that labour power out of him as possible. If it is right for the employer to get the maximum energy and pay the minimum wage, then it is equally right for the worker to give the minimum of his energy and demand the maximum of wage. What is right for the one is equally right for the other, although the interests of the two classes are diametrically opposed. That is the position, and in view of the fact that many of the workers have overworked themselves and have had to lay off through overstrain, and considering the treatment they get when thrown on the scrap heap, kicked out like dogs when they are no longer useful, they are compelled to look after their own welfare. The worker has therefore in the past adopted the policy of kakani. And I have, in the interest of the working class, advocated the policies of kakani. Not because I'm against the war, but knowing that after the war, the worker will still have the new conditions imposed upon him, I hold still to the principle of Kakani. I accede to that. Whatever is done to me now, I give notice that I will take no food inside your prisons. Absolutely no food. Because of the treatment that was meted out to me. If food is forced upon me, and if I am forcibly fed, then my friends have got to bear in mind that if any evil happens to me, I am not responsible for the consequences, but the British government are. If anything had happened to me when I was last in prison, it would have been attributed to John McLean, not to those who are working in the interests of the government. I have been able to lay down my principle and policy, not from mere internal and personal experience, but from objective experience. I studied the matter carefully. I combated the evils that were going to be perpetrated by the government by reducing my food to the minimum. And the present Secretary for Scotland knows when I was in Perth, I wrote to him asking for more food because of my reduced weight. I was about 8 stone in weight at the time, and the doctor, after weighing me, had to grant me more food. The food, however, was of no use to me. I threw it into the pot. My position is, therefore, that I take no more government food, and that I will not allow any food to be forced in upon me. And if any food is forced in upon me, I am not responsible for it. But when the government can launch millions of men into the field of battle, then perhaps the mere disposal of one man is a mere bagatelle and a trifle. It was not the workers who instigated the war. The workers have no economic interest to serve as a consequence of the war. And because of that, it is my appeal to my class that makes me a patriot, so far as my class is concerned. And when I stand true to my class, the working class, in which I was born, it is because my people were swept out of the Highlands, and it was only because of my own ability that I remained. I've remained true to my class, the working class, and whatever I do, I think I am doing in the interest of my class and my country. I'm no traitor to my country. I stand loyal to my country because I stand loyal to the class which creates the wealth throughout the whole of the world. We are out for life and all that life can give us. I therefore took what action I did in light of what was transpiring inside Russia, inside Austria, and inside Germany. You have got to bear that in mind when you wish to understand my remarks. I therefore urge the workers of this country that if they were going to strike, merely striking was useless, because they would be starved back into work again. And that if they were going to be against the manpower bill, it meant that they were out for peace. And as there was no sign on either side of coming to an amicable constitutional conclusion, then it was the business of the workers to take the whole matter in hand themselves. War was declared. No matter the motive, no matter the cause, all constitution and order was thrown aside. And in the prosecution of the war, the British government found it necessary to throw aside every law in this country and to bring in the Defence of the Realm Act, which means the negation of all law in the country. I have repeatedly pointed out that if the government wishes to get a grip of any individual, they do so under the Defence of the Realm Act. The government have power to do anything they desire. That may be right, or it may be wrong. But the position is this, that the bringing in of the Defence of the Realm Act has thrown aside all law and order as we know it during normal periods. In the plunge into war, we have the abolition constitutional methods. And therefore, I contended, and I contend today, that if it is right and proper on part of the government to throw aside law and order, constitutional methods, and to adopt methods that mankind has never seen before, then it is equally right that the members of the working class, if the war is going to cease in a reasonable time, should bring about a reasonable settlement to the workers in no victory to either side. In view of the fact that the great powers are not prepared to stop the war until one side or the other is broken, it is our business as members of the working class to see that this war ceases today, not only to save the lives of the young men of the present, but also to stave off the next great war. That has been my attitude and justifies my conduct in recent times. I am out for an absolute reconstruction of society on a cooperative basis throughout all the world. When we stop the need for armies and navies, we stop the need for wars. I have taken up unconstitutional action at this time because of the abnormal circumstances and because precedent has been given by the British government. I am a socialist and I have been fighting and will fight for an absolute reconstruction of society for the benefit of all. I am proud of my conduct. I have squared my conduct with my intellect. And if everyone had done so, this war would not have taken place. I act square and clean for my principles. I have nothing to retract. I have nothing to be ashamed of. Your class position is against my class position. There are two classes of morality. There is the working class morality and there is the capitalist class morality. What is moral for one class is absolutely immoral for the other, and vice versa. No matter what your accusations against me may be, no matter what reservations you keep at the back of your head, my appeal is to the working class. I appeal exclusively to them because they, and they only, can bring about the time when the whole world will be in one brotherhood on a sound economic foundation. That, and that alone, can be the means of bringing about a reorganisation of society. And that can only be obtained when the people of the world get the world and retain the world.